Namnet anslog den rätta patriotiska tonen. Slottet i Windsor hade symboliserat det engelska kungahuset i mer än 800 år. Ett dekret i juli 1917 kungjorde att kungafamiljens släktnamn hädanefter skulle vara Windsor. Kungen uppmanade andra medlemmar av familjen med tyska namn att genast byta dem. Prins Louis av Battenbergs familj översatte sitt namn till Mountbatten. Kungens mest besvärande släktingar, som hertigen av Coburg som slogs på Tysklands sida, klipptes av fullständigt. Kungen beslöt också att förneka sin ryske kusin tsaren, vilket fick betydligt mer tragiska följder. Ryssland hade deltagit i kriget på Storbritanniens sida och de två kungafamiljerna stod varann mycket nära. När tsaren tvingades abdikera efter februarirevolutionen 1917 fruktade han och hans familj för sina liv. De sökte självfallet skydd i Storbritannien. Kungen och regeringen gick med på att ge dem asyl, men kungens privatsekreterare hade andra idéer.
Lord Stamford came to the king and said, "It is going to make you very unpopular in England if you give sanctuary to a deposed tyrant, as he was thought, such as the Tsar. All the people who are at present clamoring for a republic in England will use this against you." The king got cold feet. And he instructed Stamfordham to reverse the decision on giving asylum to the Tsar, to tell the Russian government that there were various difficulties and so we could not accept him.
Tsaren och hans familj hölls fängslad i 16 månader och avrättades därefter. Morden förföljde deras brittiska släktingar.
They were all shot together. I believe my cousin Alexei, who was just 14 years old, didn't die at once. He was shot 3 more times. And the following day, my aunt Elizabeth, who had founded the nursing sister movement and was revered almost as a saint, was also murdered by being flung down a mine shaft.
Georg den femtes beslut att överge sin kusin och resten av hans familj tystades ner i flera decennier.
The Tsar had come to England, of course the terrible massacre of the following year would not have taken place. And what one must say of the king is that he denied the only possible chance of escape to the Tsar. And so the blood of the Tsar, in a sense, rests on the hands of King George V.
He didn't think he was passing a death sentence. He would have felt if he'd had them here, he might have been passing a death sentence on the British monarchy as well as the Russian monarchy. And what good would that have done to the world? So we mustn't give him second sight. He didn't know what was going to happen.
Seger i kriget innebar inte slutet på oroligheterna inom landet. Det förekom många strejker och upprop till revolution som i Ryssland. Trupper kallades in för att upprätthålla ordningen. I Irland trycktes nationalisterna ner med våld. Deras längtan efter republik var ett hot mot både kronan och imperiet. Georg den femte använde krona och ståt för att stärka imperiet. På Sankt Georgsdagen 1924 invigde han imperieutställningen i London.
I declare the British Empire Exhibition open.
Folk kom i stora skaror till Wembley. Fotbollsarenan hade förvandlats till en magnifik temapark med kopior av byggnader och miljöer från olika delar av imperiet. Kungen och drottningen strövade omkring bland sina undersåtar i avsikt att främja handel och förståelse mellan sina många riken och territorier bortanför haven.
George V was a passionate empire monarch. He believed that it was his destiny to rule over this vast stretch of territory spread around the whole world, which to him meant not merely power, but also almost a kind of mystical glory.
Utställningen var en stor framgång och en förströelse för det brittiska folket i en tid med ekonomiska besvär. Samtidigt som kungaparet slog ett slag för imperiet kunde de bättra på bilden av huset Windsor i journalfilmerna.
That George V was very good at was in projecting a curious hybrid image of the British royal family. That is, that on one side it was very splendid and spectacular and ceremonially grand, but on the other side he presented an image with Queen Mary and his children of middle class bourgeois domestic virtue and decency. Now, what is odd about that is that it was, in a sense, a complete fiction, in as much as the fact that the private image of the royal family under George V really didn't square with the public image at all.
Georg den femte hade ingen önskan att bo som en kung. Han avskydde kungliga slott. Han tyckte om Sandringham eftersom det var hans barndomshem, men han ville helst inte bo i huvudbyggnaden. Han föredrog ett litet hus kallat York Cottage som påminde honom om hans barndom.
It was a very poky little place, I think. My mother thought it was a wretched place. I have a feeling that Queen Mary may have too, but I think the king thought it was the cat's whiskers. It was a wonderful house because he'd hardly been brought up there.
Kungens äldste son sa, "Ni kan aldrig förstå er på min far förrän ni sett York Cottage." Där tillbringade kungen sin tid med att pyssla med sin frimärkssamling eller jaga. Drottning Mary tyckte att kungens motstånd till all förändring var tålamodsprövande, minns hennes systerdotter.
Whenever she tried to do anything, George V always said, "But I've always had it like this. My mother always did like it. You mustn't touch it, you see."
The king kept her in a very tight rein indeed. I mean, he didn't like to go outside his absolutely rigid routine. He didn't like dining out. He didn't like going to stay in country houses. He didn't like going to the theatre, if he could possibly avoid it. And, of course, she did like that sort of thing. But, of course, in exchange for that, she had a position of immense dignity, of immense wealth, I think one must say, and privilege. And she knew it, and she paid the price for it.
Drottning Marys konstnärliga begåvning fick ett ovanligt utlopp.
She liked collecting antiques from people who were not always very willing to let her have them. And there were some pretty awful stories about how she would go to your house, admire something, and make it quite clear that she would wish to be given it. And she would stay there till she got it. Awful case, I know, of Lady Hudson, who had some chairs by Angelica, painted by Angelica Kaufmann. And Queen Mary came to tea, admired these chairs, and said that she had a table painted by Angelica Kaufmann. The chairs would go very well with it. Lady Hudson did her best. But at 9 p.m., Lady Hudson gave up, and the chairs went off in the Royal Daimler.
Den som förutom drottning Mary betytt mest för kungen, hans mor, drottning Alexandra, avled vintern 1925. På kransen stod det: Till älskade lilla mamma, från dina tillgivna barn George och Mary. Kungen hade avgudat sin mor.
He would ring up and say, Mother dear, you must not go to church, you've got a bad cold. And if she did go to church, he would be there to find the places in her prayer book, like she would have done for him, for a little boy. The trouble was, she never realized that her children grew up. And when he was in his 20s and in command of a ship, he got a letter from her, which ended up with a great big kiss for your lovely little face, darling Georgie.
Däremot hade George haft dålig kontakt med sin far, och det förstörde förhållandet till hans egna barn. Han berättade för en nära vän: Jag var livrädd för min far, och jag har föresatt mig att mina egna barn ska vara lika rädda för mig.
The public image was of a very happy family, a devoted father, devoted mother. But the reality was that the family was really quite unhappy. But nobody knew about it, or at least the great British public didn't know about it. The people in the know knew, but they didn't tell.
Kung Georg och drottning Mary hade en dotter och fem söner. Den yngste, prins John, föddes med epilepsi och hjärnskador och gömdes undan tills han dog vid 14 års ålder. Kung Georg baserade sina idéer om familjeliv på sin egen uppfostran i flottan.
I was rather alarmed by him as a child, because I think he shouted to everybody rather like he commanding on a battleship.
Well, he was gruff. He had a gruff voice, he had a gruff manner. It wasn't a disagreeable manner, but it was gruff. I think he expected that if he barked, the bark would be heeded, as it were. He had a bristling beard, so that as a grandchild, your ritual kiss wasn't a wholly agreeable affair.
Now, I remember one case which shows how, without intending to be at all, King George V could be insensitive and indeed almost cruel. It was after the birth of Prince Henry. And the young Prince Edward was very curious and wanted to know how it happened and how did babies come. And the king, with the best possible intentions, produced a story about how the baby had flown in through the window. And so Prince Edward said, but where are its wings? Oh, they always get chopped off, said the king rather gleefully. And this horrific image of the baby having its wings chopped off haunted poor Prince Edward for months and weeks thereafter.
Drottning Mary gick aldrig emellan. Hon sa, jag måste alltid minnas att min make också är min härskare.
When she saw the king trampling insensitively over her children, bullying and forcing him to do things he didn't want to do, her heart bled, but she never actually turned round to her husband and said, look, you simply can't do this. You must treat your children differently.
Queen Mary was very buttoned up and very unbending. And she didn't find it easy, I think, to discuss vital things, crucial things, to show warmth, as it were, to people.
She just was incapable of what Princess Diana calls hugging. She would never hug anybody spontaneously. Didn't mean she didn't love them, but she didn't know how to express it in a natural way.
The effect of George V's martinet treatment of them and their mother's inhibited treatment of them gave them all certain neuroses. The Prince of Wales was practically anorexic when he was a child. He wouldn't eat, he was obsessive about exercising. He had these nervous tics, he was always fiddling with his cuffs or fiddling with his tie. The poor Prince Albert, later George VI, the second son, developed a tremendous stammer when he was about 7 years old, which was the central nightmare of his life.
Bertie, Albert, som av naturen var vänsterhänt, tvingades av sin far att skriva med höger hand. Kungen bestämde också att han skulle gå med benskenor för att korrigera sin kobenthet.
Prince Henry, that's the third son, didn't seem to be too badly affected. I don't think he was a man with great nerve endings, really. Prince George, the youngest, became very wild when he was a young man. He went into some pretty dashing nightlife and sex life, and at one point he was addicted to drugs. All of them, I think, drank too much when they were young men, mostly in reaction to the very strict life that they led at home.
It seems almost incredible that the royal princes could have got away with what they did get away with without being exposed to the full glare of publicity. Today, all their imperfections, their derelictions, their drunkenness, drugging, whatever it might be, would be gleefully exploited in the media and thrust down our throats every morning at breakfast.
Det som omtalades i pressen var prinsens av Wales framgångar. Efter kriget föreslog premiärminister Lloyd George en ny roll för den charmige prinsen. Han skulle fara runt i samväldet och stärka förhållandet till kronan.
That was a very good idea. First of all, it gave the Prince of Wales something to do. But also it was something that the king couldn't have done half as well as the Prince of Wales did it. And it set up a great double act, really, between this quite ordinary, decent, but thoroughly kingly man who stayed at home doing his thing and doing it well, and a young Prince of Wales who seemed very much a man of his generation and also had the extraordinary and very unusual thing, star quality. The king didn't have star quality, he was kingly, but he wasn't a star. The Prince of Wales was a star. He was wonderful at talking to people in a relaxed way and making them feel a million dollars. He could make speeches off the cuff, just at whistle stops, and people would go away with a song in their hearts.
Prinsen var den första kungliga superstjärnan, men även här stämde den glamorösa fasaden dåligt överens med den bistra privata verkligheten. Prinsen var deprimerad, på väg mot ett nervöst sammanbrott. Han kände sig ensam, otillräcklig, som ett brev till hans privatsekreterare Godfrey Thomas visar.
This was a frantic cry for help, written on Christmas Day, almost suicidal, and needless to say, it worried my father absolutely stiff. A sort of hopelessly lost feeling has come over me, and I think I'm going kind of mad. I feel faint at the thought of next year's trip, Christ, how I loathe my job now and all this press puffed empty success. I feel I'm through with it and long to die. I tell you as my greatest friend and the one man I can trust and who really understands me. I do feel such a bloody little shit.
Det dubbelnummer som kungen och prinsen av Wales utförde var utåt en framgång, men i det privata ytterst spänt. Prinsen kände att hans far inte uppskattade hans ansträngningar. Publiken applåderade, men hans far kunde bara kritisera.
Things which King George V said to his courtiers show that he genuinely thought that the Prince of Wales had made a marvellous job of, for instance, his trip to Australia, in which he'd been mobbed with the most hysterical scenes. But all he said to the Prince of Wales was, I noticed that you were wearing the wrong spurs with the wrong set of boots, or that you really ought not to be seen smoking in public, or it was all the silly little criticisms.
Kungen var upprörd över sonens egensinniga livsstil och ständiga behov av förändring. Allra mest kom de ihop sig om prinsens kärlekshistorier med en rad gifta kvinnor, som Frida Dudley Ward, vilka gjorde det svårt för honom att ingå ett lämpligt äktenskap. De flesta inom prinsens umgängeskrets gifte sig, men han dök bara upp på bröllop som best man. När hans vän Louis Mountbatten gifte sig fördunklade ceremonin av att dennes far nyss hade gått bort.
He was so shattered when he heard the news. And the prince came in to comfort him and said, but I envy you being able to weep for your father. If my father died, I'd be glad.
...1928 blev kungen allvarligt sjuk. Hela nationen följde de dagliga bulletinerna om hans sviktande hälsa. Prinsen av Wales, som befann sig i Kenya, kallades brådskande hem av premiärministern Stanley Baldwin.
When Lascelles, his private secretary, showed him this telegram, he said, oh, silly old Baldwin, just an electoral dodge, I'm not going. So Lascelles got furious and he said, sir, the King of England is dying. And if that doesn't matter to you, it certainly matters to us. And the Prince of Wales simply shrugged his shoulders and gave him a look and went out and went on with his plans for seducing the wife of a local colonial official, and was very happy to tell Lascelles that he'd done so the next morning. But I think that was when Lascelles certainly finally gave up hope.
Lascelles begärde avsked. Resten av prinsens stab övertalade honom slutligen att återvända hem. Men de var fulla av onda aningar om hans lämplighet på tronen om fadern skulle avlida. Nationens böner besvarades. Kungen fick vara kvar i livet och tillfrisknade långsamt i Bognor vid havet tillsammans med sin sondotter Elisabeth. Innan kungen lämnade orten fick Bognors stadsfullmäktige en idé att odödliggöra det kungliga bandet med staden och sökte upp kungens privatsekreterare Lord Stamford.
He went along to the king's study and he said, the town council is here and they want to call Bognor Bognor Regis. And the king, who was rather fussed, preparing to go back to Windsor, said, oh, bugger Bognor. And Lord Stamfordham bowed, returned to the delegation and said, His Majesty has been graciously pleased to accede to your request.
När kungen återvände till sina plikter hade folkets tillgivenhet för honom stärkts betydligt. Trots hans begränsade utblickar hade Georg skaffat sig rykte som en solid konstitutionell monark som han kunde vända sig till för att få kloka råd.
George V's notion of what the monarch was for in terms of politics was that he envisaged it as a sort of referee, that he was presiding over different football teams of political parties, as you might say, and that on the whole he saw his job as being to bring warring political parties together when there were periods of national crisis.
En kris för nationen kom 1931 med den stora depressionen. När handeln gick tillbaka och arbetslösheten rusade i höjden splittrades den Labour-styrda regeringen. Kungen avskydde socialism men fann inget som skrämde i Ramsay MacDonalds Labour-regeringar. När krisen ledde till att MacDonald ville avgå bad kungen honom sitta kvar och leda en samlingsregering. Kungens övertalningsförsök lyckades och MacDonald ingick en koalition med de konservativa som hans eget Labour-parti tog avstånd från.
The king took a very decisive step in that crisis, which was, I think, a disastrous step, although it was perfectly constitutional. Nobody could say it wasn't constitutional. He advised the prime minister of the day, Ramsay MacDonald, as he was perfectly entitled to do, to form a national government. He begged him to do so. And Ramsay MacDonald, very misguidedly, agreed to do it and formed a national government. As a result, the country was deprived of an effective opposition for a decade during which it was particularly necessary that the country should have an opposition.
Oppositionen tvingades ut på gatorna när koalitionen med stor majoritet vann valet. För de arbetslösa verkade det som om det var kungen som ledde regeringen, medan ingen gjorde något åt depressionen. Kungen vädjade om sammanhållning i det nya mediet radion.
Through one of the marvels of modern science, I am enabled this Christmas day to speak to all my peoples throughout the empire.
I shall always remember as a small boy listening to George V's Christmas broadcasts. His voice was extraordinary because it had a slightly sort of whiskey sort of timbre to it, as you know, it had a gamey timbre to it. It was august, but it was also intimate. He hated doing it, but he was a broadcasting natural.
Kungens första julhälsning 1932 skapade i ett slag en ny kunglig tradition.
And to those who are celebrating this day with their children and their grandchildren, to all, to each, I wish a happy Christmas. God bless you.
He wasn't a very clever man, but his heart beat with England. There's no question about that. He knew exactly the heartbeat of England, and England knew his heartbeat. No question about it. He was a very great old king, many, many respects.
Vid silverjubileet 1935 var kungen överraskad över värmen i folkets hyllningar. Vad folket inte visste var att för det älskade kungaparet föll en skugga över jubileumsfirandet. Prinsen av Wales insisterade på att visa upp sin senaste erövring, amerikanskan Wallis Simpson, som redan var inne på sitt andra äktenskap på jubileumsbalen.
Mrs. Simpson was there. The king and queen didn't know that she was invited. And I remember I was at that ball, and I remember there was a sort of frisson. And one didn't know quite what it was. But what had happened was that Queen Mary said, "Who is this woman?" And the Prince of Wales had left in a temper with her. With Mrs. Simpson.
Kungen började tänka allt mer på sin andra son, Bertie. Hans skotska fru, Elizabeth Bowes Lyon, den nuvarande drottningmodern, var ett stort stöd för honom och mycket populär. De förkroppsligade kungens uppfattning av den lyckliga familjen och deras dotter Elizabeth var en garanti för att dynastins framtid var säkrad. Men Bertie var inte tronarvinge.
If by a wave of the wand he had been able to remove the Prince of Wales and Messine, to in some way reverse the order so that his second son, the Duke of York, instead became heir to the throne, I have no doubt at all that he would have done so.
När jubileumsåret gick mot sitt slut höll den gamle kungens krafter på att sina. Hans läkare och vän Lord Dawson ville bespara familjen lidande. Drottningen bad honom att inte förlänga kungens liv. Han skrev ut en bulletin åt BBC på baksidan av en meny.
This is London. Following bulletin was issued at 9:25. The king's life is moving peacefully towards its close.
We now know that that is not true. That within 2 hours of writing that famous bulletin, Lord Dawson of Penn went to the king's bedroom, picked up 2 syringes. One he loaded with a lethal dose of cocaine, the other with a lethal dose of morphine. And he said to the nurse, inject these into the king's jugular vein. The nurse refused, and so Lord Dawson did the job himself. And within an hour or so, the king was dead.
Millions listened until after midnight, when the nation heard that the king was dead.
11:55. Lord Dawson thought the king ought to die before midnight so that the news of his death could be announced in the Times newspaper the next morning and not in what he called lesser organs of the afternoon.
Times fick sina rubriker, men sanningen bakom den kungliga dödshjälpen hölls hemlig i 50 år. Äkta sorg över kungens bortgång skakade nationen. De initierade var bekymrade över prinsen av Wales, som nu utropades till kung.
Pleased almighty God.
Edward bröt med traditionen och iakttog ceremonin.
Our late sovereign lord, king.
Bredvid honom vid fönstret stod den kvinna hans far fruktade så djupt och som han nu tänkte göra till sin drottning.
God save the king.
He was the most famous man in the world. He was the blue-eyed boy of the whole world. Everybody wanted to touch him. I mean, you know, he looked divine, and he had this terrific charm and a smile and the easy manner.
He was beloved. Beloved.
He foresaw more and more what his life was going to be, and perhaps realized that he really wasn't quite cut out for it.
Vid 41 års ålder blev prinsen av Wales kung Edward den åttonde sedan hans far Georg den femte avlidit den 20 januari 1936.
That the high and mighty prince Edward Albert Christian.
Allmänhetens tilltro till den nye kungen delades inte av den kungliga familjen. De visste att han i skymundan iakttog hur han själv utropades till kung i sällskap med en amerikanska som redan var gift.
Emperor of India. God save the king!
Men bara kungen själv visste att han planerade att göra den kvinnan till sin drottning och kejsarinna över en fjärdedel av världens befolkning. Kungen följde sin fars kista. Illa till mods ansåg somliga.
He seems uncertain as to his balance and his sort of sense of direction. And he was quite alone. It was a figure of great pathos, I thought. I couldn't possibly have known at the time what was going to befall him, but he certainly on that day looked a sad and stricken character.
Hetten Windsor hade anpassat sig för att överleva. Men kung Edvard ville modernisera monarkin och bryta med allt som hans far stod för. Många år senare erkände han att konflikter hade funnits.
My father resisted change, and even to the day he died, he still looked back to the pre-World War I days and used to say those were the good times, the good old times. We were brought up very strictly. My father was a great disciplinarian, and sometimes when my father admonished me for something that I'd done, that my dear boy, you must always remember who you are. So I used to think, well, now who am I?
I think the people around the king were always looking for what you might call the key to make him into the perfect person that they hoped he'd be. But it was somehow or other, there was something missing.
En man som hade iakttagit Edvard uppmärksamt var premiärministern Stanley Baldwin. Han ansåg att Edvard var en abnormal människa, till hälften barn, till hälften geni. Det var som om några av hans hjärnceller inte utvecklats alls, medan resten av honom var en vuxen man. Och Baldwin ansåg Edvards rastlösa sexualliv förkastligt.
There are endless stories illustrating how at the end of an evening when he should have been still dancing with the governor general's lady, he in fact had vanished with a nubile typist and appeared looking rather sheepish at breakfast next day.
Men han hade också ett behov av stabilitet och hade ett flertal bestående förhållanden med gifta kvinnor. En av dem var en charmant amerikanska, Lady Thelma Furness.
The Prince of Wales was very much in love with Thelma Furness, and then I was walking down Park Lane and I met Thelma, and she said, oh, Barbara, I was just going to ring you up to tell you I'm off to America. And so I said, oh, what about the little man? Who's going to look after him? And she always called him the little man. And she said, oh, I've told Wallace Simpson to look after him. And so I said, oh, I expect it to be all right. And she went off. And then the girl who was with me said, you know, Wallace Simpson's not very, very pretty, but she's got a great charm. I wouldn't be very happy to leave my man in for a charm. And I said, oh, don't be so silly. Of course she's all right.
Men Wallis var inte schysst. Hon stal prinsen med hull och hår. Wallis Simpson var född Wallis Warfield av en gammal Baltimore-släkt som kommit på obestånd. 21 år gammal gifte hon sig med en sjöofficer som hette Win Spencer. Han började dricka och behandla henne illa. Hon skilde sig och gifte om sig med en affärsman på väg uppåt i samhället. Han hette Ernest Simpson. Först var han smickrad av att prinsen uppvaktade hans fru. Men vid trontillträdet, när det förstulna förhållandet pågått i cirka 3 år, anade Simpson att han skulle förlora sin fru.
A clever, witty, quick, tough woman. But she had charm and knew how to use it. And of course she certainly charmed the Prince of Wales.
and so on, many others. She was American. No harm in that. But I say no harm in that deliberately because, of course, at the time, in the 30s, the Americans were still looked on as rather brash, nouveau riche newcomers.
I met Mrs. Simpson once at a very small lunch party. She was extremely elegantly dressed, but one of the hardest faces I've ever seen. The mouth like a slit.
Mrs. Simpson was after what she loved. She loved great wealth. Well, he had it. She loved making what she called a success of life. Being top historical news.
Som amerikanska av god familj var Mrs. Simpson inte undfallande gentemot kunglighet. Hon ville träffa Edwards familj på Buckingham Palace där frånskilda kvinnor aldrig släpptes in.
He wanted to bring Mrs. Simpson to meet Queen Mary because he said that if my mother met Mrs. Simpson, she would understand. Well, the very thought is really extraordinary. The thought of Mrs. Simpson, she then was meeting Queen Mary and Queen Mary understanding. Unusual thinking.
Drottning Mary hade lovat sin döde man att hon aldrig skulle ta emot Mrs. Simpson. Men Edward ignorerade familjens ogillande.
He was absolutely possessed. I've never seen a human being so utterly and completely possessed by another as he was by her.
Han uttryckte sin kärlek till Mrs. Simpson genom att tillfredsställa hennes lidelse för juveler. Han överöste henne med presenter och var med och skapade exklusiva nya infattningar för juvelerna. På baksidan skrev han intima ömhetsbetygelser och privata skämt. Medan han skar ner lönerna för sina anställda förde han över nästan en tredjedel av sin privata förmögenhet på Mrs. Simpson. Mrs. Simpsons sporadiska framträdanden med kungen gav ingen rättvis bild av hennes växande roll i hans liv. I hemlighet följde hon med honom på skidresor, till sportevenemang och privata middagar och framträdde som värdinna på hans landställe. De ritualer som följde med kungatiteln, som till exempel att ta emot debutanter vid hovet, tråkade ut Edward. Hans ungkarlsensamhet betonades av den ständiga närvaron av hertigen av York, hans plikttrogna och lyckligt gifte yngre bror, en påminnelse om kungens ofullkomligheter. Fast undersåtarna inte kände till den kungliga romansen var de medvetna om att Edward var en ny sorts kung, otvungen och okonventionell, som var fast besluten att införa förändringar. Han föredrog sin vänsterprofil framför den högra och krävde att den skulle vara på frimärkena i strid med den tradition som sa att han skulle vända sig åt motsatt håll som fader. Han var den första monark som gav sig upp i luften och skapade en flotta av kungliga flygplan. Förutom att de förde honom runt i världen smugglade de in åt couture-klänningar från Paris till Wallis Simpson, hummer och champagne. Hans uppträdande chockerade hovfolket. Men offentligt kunde han sköta de traditionella plikterna och göra det bra.
Only a few of us on parade this morning have known the awful weight of war. I hope, and indeed I pray, that never again may our age and a generation be called upon to face such stern and terrible days.
Kungen red tillbaka från Hyde Park till slottet, bröt en galning sig ut ur folkmassorna och kastade något som verkade vara en bomb mot kungen.
For a moment he really believed he was going to be killed and did behave with extreme dignity, calm. He rode quite gently on, paying no inattention, no panic at all. It was very creditable.
Det var hans finaste ögonblick. Men hans desillusionerade hovmän tyckte att det behövdes mer än mod för att bli en bra kung.
The courtiers, particularly his private secretary, had lost all confidence in him. If the king had perished in glory on that ride, I think that among the courtiers there would have been a certain amount of carefully concealed relief and a certain amount of feeling it, for thank goodness we're going to be in safer hands from now on.
Men det fanns andra hot mot den gamla ordningen. Både hovfunktionärer och politiker blev bekymrade över kungens uppenbara beundran för fascistdiktatorer i Europa och deras epigon i Storbritannien, Sir Oswald Mosley.
I should say he was very right-wing. Of course, he was miles to the right of my husband. But having said that, he had enormous sympathy with anything like homelessness or poverty or